Good morning. This is Christina Malasoff, and this is another edition of Tell It Like It Is. This is Thursday. I don't know the date. It's like the 27th, and that doesn't really matter. What does matter is that we're on WGXC 90.7 ACRA Community Radio every Thursday from 10 to 11. And I'm very happy to say that today I have... for the next hour, a recorded talk of Medea Benjamin that just occurred this last Sunday at the Unitarian Universalist Church up in Albany. And she'll be talking about drone warfare. So stay tuned for that. So, good morning. Medea Benjamin, if you were listening to Democracy Now! This morning, you know that President Obama has just approved more drone attacks in Yemen, an increase in drone attacks. Drones are something that have been used for years now. Many people don't know about it. Medea Benjamin will be talking about this important topic, including a summit that will be coming up. This was recorded. I want to thank the Women Against War, particularly Maureen Armand, who introduces the talk, and also want to thank John Flanders for recording the talk. Again, this was recorded just this past Sunday at the First Universalist Unitarian Church up in Albany. And just to let you know that the peace group Code Pink, who Medea Benjamin co-founded, and the and legal advocacy organizations, Reprieve and the Center for Constitutional Rights, are hosting the first international drone summit that will occur on this Saturday, April 28th. They are bringing together human rights advocates, robotics technology experts, lawyers, journalists, and activists for a summit to inform the American public about the widespread and rapidly expanding deployment of both lethal and surveillance drones, including drone use in the United States. Participants will also have the opportunity to listen to the personal stories of Pakistani drone strike victims. The time is 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. It's located at 900 Massachusetts Avenue, Northwest Washington, D.C., 2001. And on Sunday, April 29th, they will have a strategy session to network, discuss, and plan advocacy efforts focused on various aspects of drones, including surveillance and targeted killings. You can just Google Drone Summit and a lot of information will come up. Let's go to the talk now, and you can always call in for more information. The number here is 828-0290. Again, this was just recorded this past Sunday. It's Medea Benjamin. Let's see if we can get that going.
And that's all I'm going to say. I'm going to introduce now Maureen Armand to do further introductions.
Good morning, and thank you, Sybil Hartley, and the Peace Team of the Social Responsibility Committee of this Life Embracing Church community for allowing us to participate in this Sunday forum. My name is Maureen Armand, and I'm a member of Women Against War, and I'm grateful for the opportunity to welcome everyone and to welcome Medea to this presentation on the growing menace of drone warfare on behalf of Women Against War, which is our own regional grassroots women peacemakers network and a proud Code Pink affiliate and sponsor of this forum. Like Code Pink and so many other proactive peace organizations around the world, many of which are represented here today regionally, and also our sponsors and endorsers for this event, Albany's Women Against War came together as individual area women filled with angst and anger over the maddened will to war in Iraq, found one another, and found that in the mutuality of compassion and concern, and the coordinated efforts that resulted. They could find strength and inspiration to transform that anxiety and that rage into constructive effort. And you can go to Women Against War and Google womenagainstwar.org to find out more about that. Sadly, the need for such a community of citizen mutuality and concern has not lessened during the past decade, but becomes more and more imperative, even in the face of the people's passion for and will towards peace and justice. The forces that advocate and manipulate for war and more war, and which perpetuate inequality and injustice, continue to strengthen and proliferate. And so, Women Against War continues, and Code Pink also, as do so many sisterhoods and brotherhoods of concern throughout the country, throughout the world, continue to strengthen and proliferate and bring us together in such a forum as today's in concern. It is my deep pleasure to introduce our speaker, who, because of her tireless and intrepid commitment to putting the issues of war and peace and social inequality in front of us in every way she can, probably doesn't need an introduction. Medea says that out of her own perplexity and passion raised by the effects of the U.S. war in Vietnam on soldiers and victims, as a young person, she became committed to the issues of peace and human rights. This concern for international justice led her on the track of her formal education in both economics as well as public health, in which she holds advanced degrees, and in turn led her to live for over a decade in African and Latin American countries, and eventually to found with others Global Exchange as an effort to try to bring other Americans to those countries from which we were often so disenfranchised by our policies, in order that other Americans could also, in turn, become practitioners as well as advocates for global economic justice. And corporations often have been brought to their knees as a result of Global Exchange. Attempting to infuse the electoral process, Medea Benjamin actually had the courage to run for the Senate on the Green Party ticket in 2000 from the state of California. And since she's always on a journey, when a war of choice with Iraq threatened, Medea Benjamin, along with friends, moved to align the special perspective brought by mothers and sisters and grandmothers, the focused energies of women, to stand against the war machine and for a foreign policy based on human rights, mutual global alliance, and diplomacy. Riffing with the color-schemed threat meter designed to terrorize us by the Bush administration, Code Pink was born. And I suppose we can say the rest is and continues to be history, the people's history, a phenomenon, if you will, in that history. Code Pink is recognized the world over and has garnered and galvanized supporters everywhere as it colorfully and creatively lobbies, dances, protests, denounces, demands, warns, names names, travels the world, organizes, studies, coalesces rights and advocates for peace and a vision of the world based on the love which comes from the recognition of our inherent connection to one another as fellow planetary riders against all which robs us of that vision. And on this Code Pink journey, out in front, with megaphone or shackled hands, dressed in pink, is the amazingly intrepid voice of Medea Benjamin, who today will lead us to a new understanding of just one more bedeviling reality we have to confront as we join her on this journey. I am very pleased, as we all are, to welcome, on behalf of Women Against War, as well as all of you, Medea Benjamin. Well, that is such a beautiful intro, and thank you so much. It's great to see you, Maureen, and be in such wonderful company of women and men who have inspired me on this journey for quite a long time now. And as you said, Maureen, unfortunately, it's not one of these journeys where you get your victories and can move on quickly to the next one and get a victory and move on. And I think that's one of the things that makes it more difficult, perhaps, to get a lot of enthusiasm among the younger generation. Because I know when I started doing some of this work around the Iraq War, speaking at a community college once, it was maybe 2 years into the Iraq War, and some of the young people came up after me and they said, you know, we've been doing this for 2 years. We're really tired of this. I said, yeah, get used to it. You picked a hard one. And it is a hard one because we're part of a whole militarized society. And, you know, there are those who say war has always been with us, will be with us, like the poor have always been with us, will be with us. And we say, what about evolution? You know, what about moving on and becoming better, more civilized human beings in this world that don't kill each other? And, you know, that's what we're working towards, and it is a long-term goal. And as we look at the big picture of where we want to be as a human society that does deal with each other through love and kindness, we have to follow the evolution of the killing machine. And unfortunately, that killing machine sucks in so many resources and such incredible skill and know-how and has so much money that there are always so many steps ahead of us. We are just, you know, running to try to catch up. And we, as a society in the U.S., as a society that tries to promote ourselves internationally as a democratic model of the world, it pains me so much to see what we have done to other countries and take no responsibility for it here at home. And so for those people who were really incensed by the Bush administration, and there were many more of us than are incensed by the Obama administration, there were hundreds and hundreds of thousands of us when Bush was in power saying, how could you have lied us into a war? And then you look today, and one, you say, where are all those people? And the other is to say, why aren't we holding the Bush people accountable for having dragged us into those wars? And when you look at what we did to the people of Iraq, take a society that was already so hurting from being run by a dictator, and then having 13 years of sanctions imposed on them, and then a devastating war that we started, and to say, where is the accountability back in our country? Where is, you know, how is it that Bush, and I was going to say Cheney, because right now he's a little low-key, but, you know, it has been Bush and Cheney and Rumsfeld and Condoleezza Rice, they've all got their memoirs, and they're going around the country charging probably, like, not just tens of thousands of dollars, in some case probably $100,000 for getting on a podium here and speaking to you. And they're lauded as these great statespeople. And here we are, some lonely women that come up with our little pink handcuffs and try to get on the stage and say, you know, in the name of humanity, we want to arrest you for war crimes. And we are dragged off the stage and thought of as kooks and cranks. And yet, I hope that the people's history, when it is written, will recognize that many of us were disgusted by getting dragged into a war on the basis of lies, and are heartbroken for what we have done to the Iraqi people, and are heartbroken in the case of Afghanistan, that we have a president who thought that that was the good war and sanctioned a surge in Afghanistan and has poured billions and billions and billions of our tax dollars into that country. And what do the Afghan people really have to show for it, still among the poorest people in the world? And yet, so many have died there as well, and so many of our soldiers having died, having been maimed, having come back with terrible mental problems to a society that does not embrace them. And look at our economic situation as a result. Trillions of dollars spent on these wars,
And we have to do so much more to have people recognize how much our economic crisis is intertwined with these wars that we should have never gotten into. And on the bright side, I would say that what has changed is the perception of the American people about the Afghan war. And in the latest polls that have been taken shows an overwhelming majority, 7 out of 10 people, saying that they are against the war in Afghanistan, that the war in Afghanistan is not worth fighting, which is a pretty amazing thing for 7 out of 10 people to admit. And most amazing of all is it includes the majority of Republicans now. So here we have the public very much on our side. We have the president who says he's going to get us out of that war in 2014, but there's still a lot of debate internally in the administration and a lot of pushback coming to say, no, keep troops in beyond 2014. And there is a general war weariness in the American public, and people feeling that it's not worth the lives of American soldiers to go overseas to fight these battles. Well, people in the military have come up with a perfect solution for that, and that is to be able to fight wars without putting U.S. soldiers at risk. And that's why I think it's so important for us to look at this new technology. Not that it's coming sort of out of the blue and it's just a piece of technology. It's part of a strategy to be able to continue to wage war without having to really even let the American public know about it. Because first of all, you won't have the soldier's life at risk. There's nobody in the cockpit. And second of all, you won't really even have to go to Congress to have these issues debated, because according to this administration, when U.S. lives are not at risk, that means it's not a war, and because it's not a war, there's no reason to go to Congress. And for those of you who don't know the basics about drones, it is a unmanned aerial vehicle that doesn't have a pilot in the cockpit, where the pilots are operating these vehicles from sometimes thousands of miles away in the relative comfort of an Air Force base like Creech outside of Las Vegas, or Hancock, which is not far from you here. And I say the relative comfort because they came out with a study recently that said some of the chairs they were using while they are doing the piloting are not too comfortable, and so they need more ergonomic chairs for the pilots so they can really, you know, get back and relax while they're pressing the kill button. And meanwhile, they are pressing the kill button indeed. They are doing it in Afghanistan, where drones are being piloted in Hancock. They are doing it in countries that we are not at war with. Again, this is part of not even having to call something a war when you are using drone technology. And so I wanted to speak for a while about what's happening in Pakistan, because that's the spillover from the war in Afghanistan. And here we have the American public so overwhelmingly against the war in Afghanistan, but look at their attitudes towards the drone war. Well, the polls that have been done around people's attitudes towards drones show exactly the opposite in even a more overwhelming fashion, is that 8 out of 10 Americans think it's fine to use drones against terrorist suspects. Suspects, that's all. You know, you look a little bit like a terrorist, you know, you're a suspect, it's okay to kill you with a drone. And you might say, well, not me, I'm American. That doesn't matter. Of those 82% that said it was okay to use drones, 79% said it was okay to use drones against Americans. And what is really astounding in those statistics is when you take them apart, you see that includes the majority of Democrats and includes the majority of people who define themselves as liberal Democrats. So this has been posed to the American people, those who pay any attention even know what a drone is, as a safe way to make us safe here at home, and a more humane way because it's a more precise weapon. So look at what's happening in Pakistan. Now, I say if these weapons were so miraculous, we would have won already in Afghanistan. We would have won already in Pakistan. And here we are 10 years on, and we obviously haven't won anything. That should be enough to say that these weapons don't work. But let's break it down a little bit more. In the case of Pakistan, it's not the military using the drones, like it's the military using the drones in Afghanistan. It's the CIA. And the CIA has a secret program, and it's divided into two. One is a program where they call it the signature strikes. This is when we know your name. We know you. We are looking for you. You are on the hit list. And the other is called a personality strike. And that is when we don't know who you are, but we are looking for suspicious activity. And when we see that suspicious activity because you are carrying a gun, and that's not a good sign, although the people in northern Waziristan, where these drone strikes are taking place, the men carry guns, then we can kill you. And this has led to a proliferation of drone strikes. There have been, now it's a secret program, so what I'm saying is just what people have pieced together, not anything we can get from our own government that's open to the public. But it seems that there have been over 300 drone strikes since they started them in Pakistan in 2004. Now you might ask, well, how many people have been killed? Who knows? The best estimates we have are over 3,000 people have been killed. And some of the groups that keep the estimates try to divide into those who are militants, those who are innocent civilians, and they say about 800 of those would be innocent civilians, and among those, 175 they've calculated to be children. Now, there are people who work directly with the drone victims, like a lawyer from Pakistan who we are trying to get into the United States for a drone summit that we're doing in Washington next week. The U.S. hasn't wanted him to come here because he says something very different. He says the vast majority of those who are killed are innocent. Yes, they might be men that are carrying guns, but all the men in northern Waziristan carry guns. Yes, they might even be sympathetic to the Taliban, but that doesn't mean they're doing anything about it. It also doesn't give the United States a right to go in and kill them. And so we see in Pakistan this outcry against a program that violates the sovereignty of the Pakistani people and that is counterproductive. And in that light of being counterproductive, in the beginning when the U.S. wanted to do the drone strikes in Pakistan, they made a deal with the government, and the government said, okay, we want to kill those people too. You do it, we'll pretend we know nothing about it, and we'll deny it, and we might even have to denounce you publicly. Well, that's how it started. But then the Pakistani government realized that actually this is counterproductive. They're killing a lot of civilians, they're throwing people into the hands of the Taliban, and they're creating a lot of anti-government sentiment in the process. So they started really speaking out and saying, no, actually, we really don't want you to do these drone strikes. And the prime minister has said that. And now the Pakistani legislature has voted, including twice, most recently unanimously, to say, we don't want these drone strikes. All of the political parties in Pakistan that fight like hell with each other, they have all come together and say, we don't want these drone strikes. The people have stood up and organized massive demonstrations against the drone strike. They've even done sit-ins in the highways to block the NATO bases. And on top of that, they have gone around the world to other places, like the foreign minister has gone to England and said, can you please use your pressure to help us with the US government to tell them to stop the drone strikes? The most recent thing is they had an independent commission of parliament to look into the strikes. It came out on March 20th with its report, and the report said, drone strikes are counterproductive. They cause loss of valuable lives and property. They radicalize the local population. They create support for terrorists, and they fuel anti-American sentiments. And basically, they say they ought to stop. Well, you know, the U.S. goes around the world and saying, we support democracy, we support democracy. And yet here is a democratically elected government that is saying, please stop the strikes. And the U.S. says, no, we're going to keep going with them anyway. Not only that, instead of learning the lessons that they are creating more havoc in Pakistan, now they are trying to expand the drone strikes in Yemen. And this came out last week in the Washington Post, where the headline was, broader drone tactics sought, CIA aims to expand strikes in Yemen. And if you read this article, again, this is secret information, so it's hard to get it out, but they're trying to piece it together. And they say already the number of drone strikes has accelerated in Yemen, and with at least 8 attacks in the last 4 months. And then it says that the administration had placed tight limits on drone operations in Yemen to avoid being drawn into an often murky regional conflict and risk turning militants with local agendas into al-Qaeda recruits. Well, you know, they know that that's a risk. And yet, right now, there is intense pressure within the administration to give the CIA expanded agenda to be able to not only do those targeted strikes where you know who you're after, but to be doing the more general strikes based on suspicious behavior. They have already had terrible experience in Yemen. I wanted to give you an example of a drone strike where they had hit the wrong guy. And this was actually, they hit a key mediator who is trying to mediate between the Yemeni government and al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. He was a deputy governor in Yemen. He was killed while conferring with an al-Qaeda leader in an attempt to negotiate a settlement with the government. Well, the government was very sorry they did that. They apologized for his death. But his family was really not placated by that. And his killing prompted members of his tribe to go out and strike at government facilities, including a military camp, an oil pipeline, and power lines. And of course, now they are part of a broader movement against the Yemeni government. So you would think that there have been some lessons learned. Unfortunately, it doesn't look like that's the case. But the fact that this is still being debated and they haven't expanded these opportunities yet gives us an opportunity to weigh in on this. And I'm going to pass around right now a sign-up sheet here that is calling on the U.S. government to take the drones out of the hands of the CIA. We hope you'll join us on that because I think with the expanded secrecy, the CIA is absolutely not an agency that should be given killer drones. Yemen is not the only place where we are using these. There are operations between the CIA and the military Joint Special Operations Command, and they are also using killer drones in Somalia. We have based our drones to be used in Somalia in an undisclosed Arabian Peninsula country. Well, there's some journalists who scratched around and said, I wonder what that country is. And lo and behold, they discovered that that was none other than Saudi Arabia. Well, some of you chuckle because you might recall that one of the reasons Osama bin Laden said they attacked us on September 11th was precisely because we had U.S. military inside Saudi Arabia. And we removed the military inside Saudi Arabia, the boots on the ground, and now what we have put is drone bases inside Saudi Arabia. And it's not the only place that we have drone bases. We have now put drone bases in Kuwait, Oman, Qatar, Ethiopia. We've sent drones into Uganda and Burundi. We have, when we were leaving Iraq, made a deal with the Turkish government to have U.S. drones based in Turkey, and those drones are being used against the Kurdish people, and so it puts the United States right in the middle of a conflict between the Turkish government and Kurdish people. And most recently, we have expanded off the coast of Australia to the dismay of the Australian peace movement that never had a chance to discuss this openly in public, they discovered the drones were being based in the Cocos Islands in Australia. The concern of people around the world is looking at the example that the U.S. is setting of saying, we can put our drones anywhere, and we can kill anybody we want to, anytime we want, regardless of whether a country has invited us in or not, regardless of what their nationality is. And when it comes to this issue of nationality, as I said, it's not that we can just kill other people around the world. The U.S. government has decided that it has the right to kill Americans as well. And one of the most horrifying hearings that we saw recently was when the head of the FBI was before Congress, and he was asked, does that mean that we can also kill Americans here in the United States with drones? And the FBI said, I'm not sure about that. I'll have to get back to you about that one. So we have the example of the U.S. killing Anwar al-Awlaki, an American citizen in Yemen, who was driving in the car with another American citizen, based on the fact that they have that he was a radical cleric, and that gave us the right to kill him in Yemen. And not only that, but 2 weeks after that, his 16-year-old son was in a car driving, trying to find where his father was, and was killed by a U.S. drone strike. This is a 16-year-old born in Denver, never involved with any kind of terrorist activities, a teenager, and the U.S. government killed him with very little outcry in the United States. They have since been forced to say, yes, that was a mistake. But, you know, sorry. Well, they don't say sorry. No, they just say, yeah, that was maybe a mistake. Don't have to say you're sorry. And Eric Holder, as Attorney General, had been pushed by some of the people in the legal community to address this issue about why he thinks that it is okay for the U.S. to kill people with drones and to kill U.S. citizens with drones. And he finally addressed this issue just in March of this year for the first time, when he was speaking before a law school students at Northwestern University. And he said, look, we are fighting against an enemy that is constantly moving, and so we have the right to be constantly moving as well. And then in terms of U.S. citizens, he said, the Constitution does not guarantee its citizens the right to judicial process, only to due process. Well, the best response to this has not come really from the legal community, but came from the TV comedian Stephen Colbert. And I want to just read a little of what he said. He said, yes, the founders weren't picky. Trial by jury, trial by fire, rock, paper, scissors, who cares? He says, due process just means there is a process that you do. In this case, he said, the process is the president meets with his advisors, they decide who they're going to kill, and then they kill them. If we're going to win our never-ending war against terror, he said, there are bound to be casualties, and one of them just happens to be the U.S. Constitution. I mentioned about what does this say to people around the world, and I think we should, when we talk to others about this, give them some scenarios of what they would find acceptable. One example that we can use is Cuba. Cuba has been wanting to bring to justice a known self-described terrorist who has been living in the United States for a long time. His name is Luis Posada Carriles. He admitted to bombing a hotel in Havana in which an Italian citizen died, and he's known to have been involved in the downing of a commercial airliner. The Cuban government cannot get him extradited to Cuba. So why shouldn't Cuba send in a drone and go to the Miami condo where he is living and kill him? And if some other people in the condo were wiped out in the process, oops. What if the Chinese, and China is a large producer of drones right now. You know, the number one producer is the United States. Number two producer is Israel. Yes. Number two user of drones in the world? Israel. Yes. Number three producer is China. And China says that there are members of the Uyghur community that are living in the United States that are who are terrorists. Why shouldn't China, who now has a lot of drones, come in and go into the flat in Brooklyn where some of these Uyghurs live and just wipe them out? Iran. Iran has its own drones. And Layla told me today on the news was a news report that Iran has developed even a new drone, which is based on the drone that they downed, which was our drone. And that was a very sophisticated, one of the most sophisticated surveillance drones that the U.S. has. They put it on display for the world to see. And at first, the U.S. government was saying, God, what do we say? That's not our drone. Yes, it is our drone. How did it get there? We don't know how it get there. The Iranians said they hacked in the computer system. No, we can't admit that they hacked in the computer system. But we want to say that the drone crashed because we don't want to admit these drones crash all the time. And we certainly don't want to admit that we've been doing this for years. But it has come out that, yes, the U.S. for years has been using these spy drones over Iran. So Iran has its own drones, and now thanks to them getting one of our drones, they have more sophisticated drones. Why shouldn't they be using their drones over our airspace and be spying on us? Of course, if they did that, that would just be immediate justification for an all-out war against Iran. So how come we can do it? Because might makes right. Because we are powerful. Just because we can. Well, you know, that's not going to work too well because this proliferation of drones is happening right before our eyes. And it is estimated that there are now over 50 countries that have drones. There are more and more countries trying to buy these drones, and the drones are pretty cheap. It's not like buying one of the old-fashioned bombers that cost a couple of $100 million. You can get a drone for $5 million, you can get a drone for $10 million, you can make your own drones. And so it's pretty clear that what goes around comes around, which is one of the reasons that we should be so concerned about these drones. But there's another reason, and that is because drones are going to be used by our own government against us here at home. And that's not one of these paranoia kind of conspiracy theory kind of things. That's just reality. There is a drone caucus in Congress, and they thought that of all the things they could gather together to promote, it was really important to promote the use of drones. I think that's because they get money from the drone industry. And if you look at each of those members of the drone caucus, you can find a direct correlation between their vociferous advocacy on behalf of drones and the amount of money they are getting from drone manufacturers. And so they have a mission statement that says there is an urgent need to rapidly develop and deploy more unmanned systems in support of ongoing civil, military, and law enforcement operations. So they not only want to use more drones overseas, sell more drones overseas, they want to use and sell more drones here at home. And the only reason why this hasn't happened to a large extent already is because the permitting of drones in the United States is in the hands of the Federal Aviation Administration. And they are actually concerned about our safety and our well-being. And they know that these drones crash all the time. And they know that there is not a system yet in place for having drones overhead that know when they are crashing with a commercial airliner. And so they have been somewhat judicious about giving out permits, especially experimental permits. On the other hand, they have refused to tell us, the public, who they have given them out to. And so the Electronic Frontier Foundation is an organization that had to sue the FAA and tell them, we have the right as the public to know. Just this week, they started getting the first lists. So we now know that they have given out since 2006 between 700 and 750, they won't tell us exactly, permits to use drones in the United States. That right now there are 300 active certificates, that they include the companies that are producing the drones, like General Atomics and Raytheon and Honeywell. They include a number of universities, and some of the examples are Cornell University, University of Arizona, Colorado, Connecticut, Florida, Michigan, North Dakota, Wisconsin. They include the FBI, the military, Homeland Security, that is already using drones on the southern and the northern border, Customs and Border Patrol using those, and it includes police departments. And this experimental use of drones by police departments is from small places like Little Rock in Arkansas, from Gadsden, Alabama, from Ogden, Utah, to Miami, Seattle, Houston. And in the book, I have a section, this book, Drone Warfare, Killing by Remote Control, a section that's looking on at the use of drones here at home. We quote somebody who is involved in the drones in Houston, Texas. They get the drones by money from Homeland Security, so your tax dollars at work. And in this case, the Homeland Security gave the Texas Police Department $300,000. They got an unmanned 50-pound helicopter decked out with powerful zoom camera and infrared equipment. And the manufacturer of this drone told reporters that it's designed to be weaponized and could in the future be outfitted with what we call less than lethal systems, including tasers that can electrocute suspects on the ground, beanbag firing guns called stun batons. They said, but you know, don't worry, we're going to use them for the right thing, and I can assure you of that, he said at a press conference. Feel reassured? The ACLU doesn't. They said that we are moving closer to a surveillance society where every move is tracked, monitored, recorded, scrutinized by these drones, that all the pieces appear to be lining up for the eventual introduction of routine aerial surveillance in American life, a development that would profoundly change the character of public life in the United States. Now, they said all of this prior to a piece of legislation that was recently passed, and that is the legislation that said, FAA, you are going at this way too slowly. We need to open up U.S. airspace for drones, and we need to do it quickly. And the legislation was written by the Association of Unmanned Vehicles. It was written with the help of the Drone Caucus and with the help of the Pentagon. And they said that by 2015, we need to totally integrate drones into the U.S. airspace, and we need to expedite that for police departments. And this legislation went into the hands of Barack Obama, and he signed it on Valentine's Day, February 14th, giving a present to the drone manufacturers. And so we are going to see drones in U.S. airspace very quickly. That has a positive side, and that means that it gives us a broader community to reach out to, because unfortunately we find it sometimes hard to get Americans to be very sympathetic towards the Pakistanis or the Somalis or the Yemenis that we kill, or the Afghans overseas, but they are quite concerned about their civil liberties. And, you know, these drones can be way up high, but they can be very low, too, and they can be as tiny as an insect or a hummingbird, or they could be as big as a commercial airliner. And they could hover right there in at your window, and without coming inside your house, can see through the window and see what you're doing at home. There's a lot of libertarians, there's a lot of Ron Paul folks, there's a lot of people who call themselves Republicans, Democrats, Independents, Greens, who don't like that. And I think that we have to reach out to that broader community to say the drones are really part of something much larger, and that is part of a society that violates the very basics of a democratic society. And another group that we can certainly reach out to with this message is the Occupy movement, because the Occupy movement is the very antithesis of everything a drone and a militarized society stands for. If you look at what the Occupy society, the Occupy movement stands for, it is number one, openness. It is transparency. It is equality. It is against corporate rule. And of course, who is benefiting from the drone proliferation and the militarization? It is the 1%. It is the corporate America that both manufactures that drone, those drones, get the contracts, and benefit from a militarized society in general. When you see what a militarized society reflects back at home, it's the violence in our communities, like we see in the case of Trayvon Martin. It's the racism here at home that is magnified by a militarized society that can only get nice young women who go into the military to turn into horrible killers by telling them that these are not real human beings. They are not like us. They are ragheads. They are, you know, the slang that they use when you push the kill button with the drone is when you have killed somebody, they call them bug splat, because on your screen, on your computer screen, it looks like you crushed a bug. They call the people who are running away trying to get out from beyond the drone attacks the squirters, and they send in another drone attack immediately after to get the squirters. Well, this kind of language, this kind of teaching of people that others are not real people comes back to haunt us, to reinforce the racism that is already so much a part of our society. A militarized society is a very sexist society. And look at the rampant rape within the military, and that how that then comes back at us when these young women, men and women come back into our society. And then, of course, there is the issue of just the terrible skewing of resources. And we have to educate people in our society about the massive amount of money that we spend on these wars that is never ending. You know, the height of the money we spent on the Vietnam War was not during the Vietnam War. It was in 2010, when you look at all the money being spent on the veterans and their health care when they get to be the age that they were in 2010. That is the height of the spending. So the spending goes on for decades and decades after the wars are long gone. So really, an end to militarism should be part and parcel of what we work as part of the Occupy movement. And so I want to end on a hopeful note, because I do think that many of us who've been doing this work for decades and decades started to get very discouraged when we said, where is the younger generation? And oftentimes when we come to gatherings like this, it still tends to be the older folk that come together. But now we are not alone. Now we are part of a much broader movement. And that broader movement, when we bring these messages, is so open to hearing that movement, and so readily understands the connections that we're trying to make, the connections of trying to end violence, whether it's violence here at home or violence overseas, the connection that we're trying to make towards a society that treats its citizens with dignity here at home and treats people around the world with dignity, and starts to understand that we will never have the resources we need to have a decent healthcare system in this country, to give our kids an education where they're not debt slaves after they get their education, and to rebuild something like our depleted housing system here at home without taking the trillions of dollars that we are spending at war and investing it into our own resources. It was interesting. I was listening to a show on Al Jazeera the other day, and it was the ambassador of the United States in Iraq. And he was giving an interview on a show called Fault Lines. And it was just fascinating, because he was saying, you know, the Iraqi people, they don't like these foreigners that are coming into Iraq and getting involved in their internal affairs, meddling in their internal affairs. And the Iraqis, more than being Shia and Sunni and Kurds, they are Iraqis, and they are a proud people. And they don't take kindly to others coming in and trying to insert their views. And he said, right now, they're saying to these foreigners, don't put money into our system and try to influence our elections. Take your money and keep it at home and worry about your own elections. And I thought, wow, that's amazing. That's the ambassador of the United States in Iraq. But guess what? He wasn't talking about the United States. He was talking about Iran. He was talking about Iran's interference in Iraq. Just imagine that. Astounding, astounding, the level of imperial blindness, one might say. So I do want to end on the note of saying that empires come and go, that we are in a period where our empire is in decline, but it's still out there flailing around the world. And we still have over 800 military bases overseas. We still have a military-industrial complex that is churning along. In fact, one of the areas where we are still a producer is in producing these weapons. And when you go to these congressional hearings, they'll say, well, we can't close down the production of these weapons even if we don't need them because we need the jobs. We still have a government, no matter whether it's Democrats or Republicans in power, that feed the military machine. On the other hand, we now have a new generation. On the other hand, we now have an Occupy movement. On the other hand, we have renewed enthusiasm in this country for looking at it separate from the political parties, for understanding that we need a movement that is not attached to a political party. That when we're out there saying no to George Bush and his indefinite detention and his renditions and his torture and Guantanamo, when Barack Obama comes in and says, let's not do Guantanamo, it's messy, let's just kill these people with drones, we gotta be out there saying that is wrong. So I'm excited that we have a lot of opportunities coming up. We have NATO coming up, where people like Joe Lombardo here have been working nonstop to get people out to Chicago to protest the NATO alliance. We have the conventions coming up this summer. Right now we have the spring, the Occupy Spring, where we have the corporate shareholder meetings that are coming up, and there's going to be amazing protests at so many of those. We are part of a much larger movement now. And so as part of that larger movement, we just have to make sure that when we say we are trying to build a greater democracy here at home, let's make that reflected in a better democracy in the way we work with the world. When we say that here at home, we are trying to build a movement that doesn't allow people to stand their ground and kill young people of color at will, that we don't allow our military to stand its ground and kill people of color at will around the rest of the world, that we are building a society that is based on love and compassion and kindness, and as we are building that here at home, we are building that same kind of foreign policy that shows love and compassion and kindness to the rest of the world. Thank you.
That was Medea Benjamin, Code Pink, co-founder. Quite a remarkable talk. If you want to hear that talk again, WGXC will have that in the archives under Tell It Like It Is. That should happen in the next couple of days. In the meantime, that was Medea Benjamin, who was recorded by John Flanders last Sunday at the First Unitarian Universalist Church up in Albany. She has written a book called Drone Warfare, Killing by Remote Control. The foreword is by Barbara Ehrenreich. And there will be a summit this April 28th, this Saturday coming up, 28th through 29th. It's in Washington, D.C. Go to the Code Pink website for more information. And if you can't attend, definitely, if you can lend your support, and find out, make sure you find out more about this important issue. That's all for Tell It Like It Is. We will be back next Thursday between 10 and 11, and we'll take it out with a little music. Thank you for listening.
Really don't mind if you sit this one out. My words but a whisper, your deafness a shout. I may make you feel that I can't make you think. Your sperm's in the gutter, your love's in the sink. So you ride yourselves over the fields, and you make all your animal deals, and your wise men don't know how it feels to be thick as a brick. The sandcastle virtues are all swept away in the tidal destruction, the moral malaise. The elastic retreat rings the close of play as the last wave uncovers the new fangled way. But your new shoes are worn.